And we are back with episode 273 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I hope none of us are standing on a trapdoor by the time we get to the end of this episode.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and apparently I'm talking to you via a CNN satellite hookup.
Yes, unfortunately we're dealing with a little bit of a lag here, so hopefully the editing will take care of that one, and it's not going to wind up being a collision course type of situation, but we're going to power through it anyway. But we are going to be also talking about Person of Interest, Supernatural, and Arrow. But first, Edmund, if you could please.
As ever, we will be talking about absolutely anything and everything in these episodes, so you must be warned that you will be spoiled. But we have left at least a week or so you've had a chance to catch up before we do so.
That's right, and we are going to go ahead and start off with Person of Interest, and here's the promo.
They can stop crime before it happens. But CBS next Thursday.
Welcome back, John.
They'll face an old enemy they never saw coming.
He was wired with a bomb vest. You're gonna run a few errands for me.
What are you gonna do? Shoot me?
All right, and Edmund, if you could please.
Sure. This is Person of Interest, Season 2, Episode 13, Dead Reckoning. Reese's former partner, Kara, abducts him as part of her scheme to unleash a wave of cyber terrorism across the world and get revenge on the people she believes wronged her. Although I think she's been getting a revenge on one of the people who wronged her for quite a little bit of time now. But yeah, this episode, about halfway through it, I was starting to feel a little bit like there was a bait and switch going on with this. You know, the amount of buildup that Kara Stanton's gotten between all the flashbacks and then discovering she was alive at the end of last season and running around with Snow in his bomb vest, you know, doing her bidding for half a season now, and with his limp and however she inflicted that on him, other than the shooting. But, you know, this is like built up as, she was sort of going to be the next supervillain like Elias or Root. Then we get into the episode and it kind of felt like, you know, okay, so she's arranged this little reunion of the old team and, stuck John in a matching bomb vest to Reese's. But there's kind of this sort of gun for hire quality going on. You know, it's kind of making me feel, wondering just what they were going for with this. It was well done, and some of this stuff going on with the rest of the team I really enjoyed as well. Carter, of course, managing to get out of the wreck, in time to avoid the authorities, and then get immediately called back to the scene to consult, since she'd been working with Donnelly, of course, and after the, I was kind of amused since they did have this big 3-week layoff for reasons I still can't quite figure out, other than, I suppose, sweeps coming up. So they gave us that whole little recap of what had happened, just in case we'd forgotten. And I loved when she got back on the crime scene and Fusco's there, immediately mentioning, like, oh, you've lost an earring? And, and then waiting until she's digging around hunting for it to actually reveal that, yes, he had it all along. I kind of took as, one of those signs that, Fusco is, really getting his confidence and is, feeling much more like a full member of the team. I think his little interlude with the supermodel last time, has really done a load of good to his self-confidence level. Yeah, so, I mean, as much as, what was going on was, I sort of had this feeling of, they're back doing, doing the same kind of thing that they were doing before. And sure, there was the whole issue of exactly what she was doing and why she was doing it. And then I guess it was about halfway through when we get the flashbacks that are initially, kind of, again, giving us a bit of a recap of the end of the China mission and the two of them being ordered to kill each other, which I thought was good for any newer viewers who weren't fully up on all the backstory, just to fill them in on that. And then, where everything really turned was the latest well-dressed man with the British accent comes to visit her in the hospital and gives her the whole little mythology lesson about the Titans and how they wound up choking on their children's offerings, basically, and then offering her deal to, work for the new gods and help choke off the old gods that set her up, you know, where everything turned around and turned out that, you know, yes, we were in a bit of a bait and switch, which was made even clearer by the end of the episode. But unlike in the real world, where a bait and switch is something that usually leaves you disappointed, this was a switch that was actually just taking things in a whole new direction and, you know, introducing some whole new possibilities. And, by the time they worked it through, and, you know, I did really, really like the twist of that basically Kara was, you know, counting on the fact that Rhys was going to try and sabotage the mission to basically make it all work. That, you know, no, the mission was not to get something out, but was to basically have them be the diversion that allowed her to get in and, you know, and plant this malware, you know, in this very vulnerable and now open site. And, you know, of course, the fact that what she planted, what will take 5 months to compile, you know, it should take us just about to the season finale. Was,
yeah, imagine that.
Yeah. Very, very nicely done. And then certainly just that whole, you know, at the end when she just abandons the two of them to their ticking vests and, you know, John goes up to the roof to make a sacrifice, except, of course, Finch is there to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, it was a bit of high-tech puffery having the whole five numbers and three attempts, except you know you're not going to blow up Michael Emerson and Jim Caviezel on the roof, so... You knew they weren't going to blow up, but it was still just, you know, what has always made this show work so well. Just the exchanges between them were just so well done. You know, what are you going to do? Shoot me? And it's my process from Finch, and, you know, and Rhys sort of looking on, you know, slightly bemused, you know, although anxious at the same time, whether this was going to work. And then just a lovely little nod of having the countdown end at 0007, just like Goldfinger does. And, you know, it's Rhys ascending and then Snow descending, supposedly to get help. But in fact, no, just, you know, because he knows he's going to die and he just has to make sure that Kara does too. And, you know, so we wind up with... you know, this real clearing of the decks. I mean, we had, you know, Donnelly taken out last time. We've got, you know, even if there is that slight little glitch in the security camera, you know, and I think certainly the intention is that, no, that Snow and Stanton did go up in the car. They're just, you know, maybe leaving just a slight possibility because this in sort of the backstage stuff. I mean, both of those actors have other gigs they're working on right now, you know, but if, you know, say the following doesn't work out quite as well as Fox might be hoping, you know, Stanton might have an opportunity to return. Who knows? But certainly the intent seems to be that, you know, it's sort of clearing the decks and, but then setting up this, this whole new threat with, the new British man in the suit. And I had to do some checking on who this guy was and was very intrigued to discover that, no, that's, Jonathan Christopher Nolan's uncle, playing him. 'Cause, you know, certainly has, you know, the gravitas that we expect of, you know, sort of the better known British actors like a Ian McKellen or a John Hurt, but, you know, but with that sort of anonymity of just having had this very long distinguished career in stage and British TV and outside of Hollywood. You know, he has appeared in the Nolan Brothers movies, but is not that well known outside. So it's this very, very strong, this strong presence, but still kind of anonymous and mysterious. We presume, you know, will be the sort of the driving force for this back nine and in the end of the season finale is this whole scheme is about to go live.
Yeah, I'm wondering now, obviously they led up to, at the end of the episode, the revelation that I guess Finch was in some way involved with all of this. And it seems like, you know, we've known for some time that there were intersections between Finch and Rhys in their previous lives, but now it seems like there's even more of an intersection than we may have anticipated. So I guess, you know, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, that was the other sort of major twist, even though the funny thing was, I mean, as the episode was spooling out, I mean, when he got to saying the name, and especially the way, you know, that, you know, they cut away from actually hearing it, I mean, it was no surprise to me when, you know, no, it was Finch's name on that piece of paper and the debris at the end.
Right.
You know, but it just sets up the, you know, all of these implications of, okay, so, you know, what were the circumstances that led up to him selling that laptop. And I can't help but think that it has, you know, something to do with, you know, possibly both Nathan's death and even his limp. And, for all the implications that, it is kind of baffling in terms of why he would do that. But, you know, I'm sure once it gets revealed that, this will not wind up being a threat to the team. I mean, I'm sure they'll play it up as that. But what also intrigued me about it was when we sort of saw that first, you know, sort of seemingly casual hospital hallway meeting between, you know, or sighting between Finch and Reese. You know, that seems semi-random, but now I wonder if, you know, no, Finch wasn't well aware of Reese's involvement in that, and that was part of what, led to his interest in him. Mm-hmm. In the first place,
right?
So, you know, that all that is, you know, certainly the other half of what I hope they will be exploring for the rest of this season and not leaving till next season.
No, because the sense that I got, and Bronsthumb, I'm curious your thoughts on this too, is that the whole point of this episode, quite apart from what we may have expected, was that Kara and everything that she did was to introduce this concept of this relationship between Finch and Reese that we didn't really anticipate existing before. And that it was really just a way of moving from, say, where they were before to where they are now, because a lot of this season has been, surprisingly enough, this odd, I would say, attempt to play up the possibility of conflict between Finch and Reese. And we've seen that kind of on and off.
Mm-hmm.
But every time that they seem to be going in that direction, they remind you of why they work so well together in the first place. So, you know, and then you get that moment at the end of this where they really seem closer than they've ever been. So, yeah, it does strike me as a really good time to play the game of, oh, now that we've gotten them so close and so on the same page, now we've got to find a way to really create a rift between them by having Reese discover whatever secret that Finch has been keeping. But I'm with you where I feel like they're going to play it up, but in the end, it's still going to turn out to be just fine. Because even though they've done a really good job of playing against expectation, this is still a CBS show, and I would be really surprised if they were to mess with things that much.
Yeah, definitely.
Bronsthumb, your thought on this episode?
See, I don't think they will be as reticent to play up a potential rift between Reese and Finch, because they've been laying the seeds of it from the season, just showing how we had a couple of episodes that show how Reese functions as the only person listening to the machine. We've had an episode that shows how Finch functions being the only person listening to the machine, and all these potential places where they won't, you know, situations and scenarios and moral questions and that kind of thing where they're not necessarily going to be on the same side of things. And they have come about as often as the big friendship moment. And I don't necessarily think it'll be over the issue of their shared backstory or anything like that. But I do think that that is going to be something that they address and deal with and will actually be an arc within the show. As for the reveal that apparently Finch was the one who sold this laptop, it's just playing a bit more on, I don't know, up to this point we've had the very slow reveal that the lives of these two men have been intersecting in all kinds of interesting ways. I mean, the stuff with Jessica, the stuff with the development of the machine and stuff like that. When we had the thing of you know, oh, he's so secret, we've only got his name and can't find anything else. I mean, I was like you, Edmund. I just assumed, yes, this is going to be Finch, but it's going to be Finch's name, but I'm not 100% sure it's actually going to be Finch. I'm tossing up between Finch and between Nathan, because I don't know. I feel like that's a scenario in which Nathan could have been. You've got a few things reasons that could play out. I mean, Nathan's guilt, I guess, over what the machine can, something like, it's not about doing it for the money, it's about just making sure this isn't something that's solely in the hands of the US government, and then that that puts him in the cross government, and that's how he and Finch both that's how he wound up dead and Finch wound up injured, and Finch sort of had this resolve to to do better with the machine in S4. That's my thinking on it. Hopefully, we'll get to see exactly what happened as goes on. But I don't think they'll get away with not showing it at some point this season, because vague hinting that something bad happened in the backstory, but are not really needing too many of the details. I mean, they've moved to, okay, there is an active mystery. Like, the art that has something to do with this sold laptop really puts a focus on that. As for the rest of the episode, I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Putting the A-team together and then having them sort of semi-compete with Finch and Carter and Fusco was really, really great. I agree that that Fusco is a more active member of the team, and that, yes, saving a supermodel will probably do wonders for your self-confidence. I think, you know, everyone should try it, really. Uh-oh, I think they're onto me.
Yeah.
I really dug that the way that Stanton's whole plan, her way of operating, and you know, using Reese and Snow as the equivalent of the place. Problem is, I knew going into this episode that the actress is a regular on The Following, and therefore it's unlikely she'll be quite so recurring from here on out. I do think they're dead. I know, you know, the whole never saw the body thing, but I do think both those characters are dead, because we've sort of, with Snow, I think we'd gotten to the end of what the writers could do with him in the show. And as much as I really like Stanton, I feel like she sort of, her as both a character and a function of the show have sort of fulfilled their purpose as a plot device. She's given us a lot of backstory on Reese, on that particular time in his life, on the CIA, and now she's introduced us to this new group of bad guys and this new set of plot threads and blah, blah, blah. Story, both of...
Uh-oh.
I think the machine's finally gotten him.
I think so. Well, as we wait for it to see if Bronstum can come back and can continue on, certainly I would have to agree with a lot of the thoughts here, but I think that this was more of a transitional episode than any of us were probably expecting. Certainly in terms of wrapping up. I mean, I completely agree with Bronstum that this was a natural end to Snow's side of this. I think that they'd pretty much worked all of that out. I'm a little surprised that this was the end of Kara's journey, but now that I think about it, I do agree that it makes sense that this would be it, because really, what else is there to do? I mean, we've gone through her backstory and what was going on with her and Reese, so yeah, I mean, we how many different ways are they going to show us the same background? And if they added too much to it, then I think it would have been a little... It would start to lose credibility. Even as they start to weave in all this stuff with Finch, you know, that's fine, and it works well enough. I think that the stuff with Stanton had reached its natural conclusion as well, now that I, you know, have a bit more time to think about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It just really amused me, because as I've been writing the review this afternoon, I was rewatching different parts of the episode, and you know, and going back and checking again, it's like, you know, yeah, guys, you did just have to put that little glitch in the security camera just before it explodes. You know? I saw that, and it was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure they're dead, and I absolutely agree that in terms of the, you know, their purpose in the story, you know, it has reached its natural conclusion, but. I was still feeling like, you know, no, they're leaving themselves a little out just in case, but most likely. And you know, I think it serves the story best if they're
right.
But I mean, first time through, what I was actually thinking about more was, I mean, we reached the point where anytime it's a security feed shot like that, especially if something we've already seen in sort of, you know, regular camera, you know, sort of the automatic, you know, I was initially going towards, you know, it's like, well, wait a minute, was the machine setting this up? And it was like, well, no, he couldn't have set this up, you know, but it was more, you know, no, he's just making sure daddy's protected.
That's it.
You know, because obviously the machine has heard the call, so he knows that she just got the names. He's just checking and making sure.
That's it. So what did you give this episode, Edmund?
I was starting out more with an 8, but this is one of those cases where the more I started, it was more as I started writing it up and then rewatching the episode, I wound up bumping it up to a 9 because I, you know, some of the slight reservations I had initially were, you know, kind of washed away as I, you know, in the first place. I mean, I think it was rewatching parts of it, knowing it was more this transitional episode rather than sort of, you know, the big, you know, new villain introduction with Stanton that I was expecting, and seeing it in that light, I just thought it was really, really well done. And certainly, you know, this was the 13th episode, and that's sort of, you know, standard front 13 and back 9 setup. I mean, this is, you know, definitely a very good conclusion to the first part of the season and set up for the next.
Mm-hmm. And Bronstam, how about you? What would you give this?
I would give this one a 9. I don't think it was quite as good as the previous episode because, I don't know, it's the difference between having to do some plot-based heavy lifting and just being able to revel in the characters and the stuff they've already set up. You know, last episode got to pay off a bunch of things, whereas this episode it's setting up the new bad guys, it's through the flashbacks, and giving us a lot of new information. But I really dug all the new information, and I'm interested in the new bad guys, and it was a really, really exciting really, really exciting ride in the meantime. I mean, the scene on the roof with the phone, I was never in doubt for a second that they would fix it, but I think the point of the scene was to go for the emotion of the friendship and just how that's evolved, and how even when Reese can convince Carter and Fusco to leave and let him die, he just knows there's no way he's getting Finch to back off, and Finch is just not going anywhere. It's really touching, and it's going to make it all the more heartbreaking when something happens, because I feel like they've done too, unlike Supernatural, they're too good at following through on their own setup.
Mm-hmm. But of course, if we want to talk about friendship, we at least have to just briefly mention the Bear-Reese reunion.
Yes.
As Michael Emerson said, that dog will upstage you every time.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether or not he was looking with bemusement and happiness over, you know, that these two are reunited, or he was a little bit jealous.
Yeah.
But, all right, so let's see. That was 2 9s, and I think a little bit surprisingly, I'm going to slip back a little bit to an 8. I think that they may have pushed their timetable on Snow and Kara a little bit faster than they were intending because of the whole question of her availability, the actress. And I get the sense that a few things were rushed as a result. And for that reason, I'm not quite as high on this episode as maybe you guys are, but certainly I think that it is still above average. So I wouldn't argue any lower than that by any means. All right, well, let's see. We are then wrapped up with Person of Interest, and we can move on to, and Bronstam, nice segue that you provided us with there, Supernatural, and here is the promo.
Which of you is John Winchester?
Where'd you come from?
1958. Abaddon.
She's from hell.
This is not your idea of a happy ending.
She must be stopped.
Who the hell are you?
Henry Winchester.
That's our grandfather.
All right, and Bronstam, if you could give us the recap here.
I can probably manage that. Supernatural Season 8, Episode 12, As Time Goes By. Sam and Dean's grandfather travels forward through time to the present to get help from John Winchester in stopping a demon, Abaddon. So a comment that I made on the website for the review of this episode, in response to some of the things the review was talking about, was that Jeremy Carver has sort of talked a bit about, since becoming showrunner, the direction he wants to go with the show. And despite the fact that this is the 8th season, he's actually sort of gearing up to do a multi-year arc kind of thing, which I found really, really interesting. I have a much easier time swallowing it in the wake of this episode, which I think is we're going to wind up looking back at as the signs and portents of the Jeremy Carver years on Supernatural, assuming they are years. I don't know if there's been any kind of renewal notice or anything, but
not yet, no.
Yeah, this episode was a solid episode. It was a big info dump. It was putting a lot of information on the table, a lot of new mythology on the table, and connecting it up to things from the past, things that have sort of been relevant since the 8th season, and well, going back several years, such as, you know, the Crowley and the Hell stuff, perhaps as well to the Naomi stuff, but I'll get a bit on that later. But also circling back to the very early years of the show, when Sam and Dean being the sons of John Winchester was a way bigger deal than it than it is now. And I mean, I'm not surprised that it's not so much a big deal now, because who's going to remember John Winchester, a Marine Corps grunt turned hunter, next to his kids who stopped the apocalypse at least once or twice? Mm. Like, you know, they've done a good job of making their own name, but this idea that there's like a brother or you know, a brother organization to the hunters, that, you know, the I'm struggling to think of good metaphors other than sensitives and actives, which is, I have no idea how many people are going to get that, but just the idea that for all the hunters who have this really, really cool blue collar approach to fighting evil, that's sort of what distinguished the show, distinguished Supernatural from other shows of its ilk, as it's gone on, is the idea of the much more scholarly, wizardly, you know, the men of letters idea, although I'm not so sold on the name, but just the idea that this guy shows up and he knows a ton and he's commanding magic and he's doing, he's got this whole other perspective, and I found it really, really interesting. And between that and introducing this warehouse and the suggestion that there are other men of letters still out there perhaps but in hiding, I think we're sort of seeing a bit of the story arcs that kind of got touched on a bit in seasons 5 and 6. The idea that now that in the wake of the apocalypse, the thing that was supposed to happen, where this is the story of the characters who are going to figure out what the world is going to be from now on. And it puts Sam and Dean in a much more prominent position than I think they've been in several years. They're not just the really, really good hunters. Them being Sam and Dean Winchester is an incredibly significant thing. And I thought that was cool, just the idea of introducing these, you know, Abaddon, like, what was it, Hell Knights?
Yeah.
Just, you know, badder than bad demons, which is kind of good because, I mean, kind of the whole reason they stepped up to Leviathans in Season 7 was that, well, our guys have been ganking demons pretty regularly for a couple of years now. So it's a chance to kind of, you know what, we're going to stick with demons, but we're going to beef up some of them and make it a thing. There was also this mention, and maybe I completely misheard this, and I haven't had the chance to rewatch the episode, but I swear he mentioned Dark Angels. And I seriously doubt he was talking about Jessica Alba's television career.
Yeah, I don't remember that either, but it would make sense. And certainly that would open up some doors with Naomi.
Yes, that was exactly I heard that, and it was the first thing I heard. And please, people who, listeners who have had that chance to maybe who's caught a few more of the details or got to watch the episode a couple more times, please let me know whether or not I'm completely barking up the wrong tree. But yeah, I swear I heard him mention Dark Angels, and that throws the whole Naomi storyline into a completely different light, because this is, I mean, Castiel was kind of a big deal when that all happened. So who are the guys, who are the angels that are kind of bad?
Right.
If we've seen what a good angel does when they kind of go down a bad path, who are the ones that we just sort of categorically call not so good?
Yeah. I agree with you that this could have been a better episode in terms of just the overall quality if they hadn't felt the need to use it as a huge whopping info dump. That was my probably biggest problem with it. However, I can't argue too much with the information that they decided to give us, because, like you, my first thought is that, wow, this is something that we suspected back in season 1 or 2, that the Winchesters had this family legacy that they were really following up on and just weren't completely aware of. And then the next thing we know, we get, you know, this episode coming in and telling us that, oh yeah, it wasn't just that Mary's family was the Hunter family, and that, you know, that was just a big bait and switch. No, there was something about the Winchesters that was fairly important, and maybe it's the fact that these are the children of both the Hunters and the Men of Letters, respectively, that makes them something special. That the reason that the Winchester Gospels are so important is not just because they have stopped the apocalypse, but because of who they are in their backgrounds and their lineages. Like, I think I said in the review as a little bit of a joke that if they ever do put out the Winchester Gospels, what we're going to see are the, you know, just like in a couple books of the New Testament, these huge lineages showing how this is the Winchester lineage, this is the Campbell lineage, and this is how they come together in Sam and Dean. And this is why they were who they were, and this is why they're so important, and this is what they did. And then we've got this other thing going on, which, like you said, I didn't really catch this thing that Jeremy Carver said about this multi-year arc, but I would love it if it were true. You've got this implication that there are things that people, that no one should have their hands on. And now we've heard about the demon tablets. We've heard about the angel tablets. We now have a repository of things that are thousands of years worth of things that were just kind of tossed into a repository. And no one but the right people should have their hands on this. And the only people who are the right people are the legacies of the men of letters. So taking that into account, either that that warehouse is going to become the central thread for this multi-year arc, or this season is going to be wrapped up, because now that they have the key and they've already been told the best thing that you can do is take the key, toss it in the doorway, and lock it forever, is that they're going to realize that the angel and demon tablets, that nothing good is going to happen until those are out of play. And the only way to do that is to lock them away in the repository. So, yeah, to me, they're throwing all that out there. They've got the Knights of Hell, which makes me wonder, was Lilith one of them? Or was that? Are they just kind of playing off of that? I mean, we see a lot of retroactive.
I wouldn't be surprised if they stitched that together.
Yeah, and I would expect some of that, because I feel like Jeremy Carver probably understands that there are certain characters, or not characters, but elements of the fandom, that feel like the show went a completely different direction right around season 4. When Castiel came in and the angels were introduced and all of that. And it's not the easiest thing in the world to take the early seasons and the later seasons and meld it together completely. So I think he's kind of finding a way to do that, while at the same time not ignoring any of the things that have been built up since then. So, you know, we kind of talked a little bit, or at least I had, especially in the last review that I did for Fringe, that Fringe and Supernatural, we've said many times, are the heirs to the X-Files. And where Fringe did the huge mythology really, really well, what Supernatural seems to be doing is, how do you go beyond the life cycle of your original mythology arc? Introduce something new, but not
screw it up. And it's had a few...
Yeah.
Yeah, they've had their seasons 6 and 7,
and
just like the X-Files did, so... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
I don't know, personally I think season 6 really... Personally, I think season 6 really, really worked really, really well, but I'll give, like, that's one on which your mileage will very much vary depending on the type of stories you like. Season 7 really didn't go so well at all, and season 8 has been patchy thus far, but then again, I'm going to make the signs and portents comparison. Season 1 of Babylon 5 was kind of patchy before we had this episode that in the midst of a fairly interesting A story brought in a character who just gave us loads and loads of information and set up for future stories that show would play on for years and years to come.
It does
go a long way to stitching together all these different. It does go a long way to stitching together all these different eras of the show.
I'm going to disagree with you in one respect. Certainly, season 6 we know came in a little low because the whole thing with Dean and Lisa just never worked out. Not unlike Sam and Amelia this season, but. Even with the Sam and Amelia stuff this season, there's only one episode that came in under average. The rest of them were all average or above. And the one that didn't work was that Hunter I Heroikai one that was just a premise that was not executed at all well. Otherwise, I think that this season has been a step forward in many respects. And this episode, again, I think is, as you said, we're going to look back on this as being the big change and shift towards something bigger for the season and for the future of the series. And let's face it, even though they keep on keeping the budget, at least if not lowering it, at least keeping it stagnant, we know that the CW has no intention of getting rid of the show. It's probably one of their biggest fandom type shows on the air right now. I don't know how better to put that. But let's say that it has the best critical and fan acclaim out of all their shows. Even taking into account The Vampire Diaries or even Arrow right now. Why would you turn around and mess up a good thing? And you've got people on both sides of the equation, both in terms of Jared and Jensen, and in terms of the writer's staff and the production staff, that are kind of reinvigorated on the whole thing. And we're in year 8.
Yeah. You
know, where to go back to the X-Files comparison, the big problem that they had with trying to come up with a new mythology with new characters was that they never fully committed to it. Just when you felt like they were finally starting to create a mythology around the new characters, they came back and made it all about Mulder and Scully again. Because they were listening to one segment of the fans and not really paying attention to what would be best for the show. I think Supernatural is doing the exact opposite. Now, granted, they're not trying to replace their two main characters with somebody else, but so they
that might be a little disastrous.
It would, but I think at the same time, what they've managed to do is they've given the characters enough depth and enough history at this point that instead of just to go back again to the X-Files thing, instead of going off of some fan-based iconic versions of the characters, they're staying true to the characters as they are. Dean is still Dean. Sam is still Sam. They have had this history for 8 seasons, and it's there on their faces and in every action and decision that they make. And that, I think, is what people are responding to. These characters are still true to who they are. They don't change from episode to episode based on who's writing the episode. You know, it's some of the things that we always say are really good about something like Buffy or Angel, because yes, while you could tell when a writer was actually writing an episode, the characters were distinct and consistent over time, most of the time. Angel, there were a few issues later on, but anyway. Back to Supernatural. So yeah, this was an info dump, which took a little bit of the shine off of it for me, but I think that I'm very excited by what this actually introduces. And as long as they manage to do a little bit more of the retconning without making it too obvious and contradicting anything, I think that it's really boding very well. Edmund, I don't think that you've had an opportunity to jump in too much on this at all. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, well, with this one, I knew, I mean, it was so tied up in the mythology of the early seasons that I'd let you two who really know all that stuff run with it. But one comment I wanted to make was, I mean, as the person who jumped in post-apocalypse, I think they actually did a really good job of, you know, of still, you know, there was still the, you know, the chasing and killing the demon aspect, but, you know, as much as it was an info dump for someone who didn't know that much about the early history, you know, I was still able to follow everything. And I actually had a funny thing happen where, you know, of course, Arrow and Supernatural are right after each other. And I actually watched Supernatural first, and my DVR cut off the previously, it started Supernatural right after the previously on. So I was seeing the episode without any of that backstory, and I was still able to follow it. And then when I watched Arrow and then saw the preview song, I was like, oh yeah, well, that would have helped. But as it turned out, I didn't actually need it. You know, I was able to follow along well enough.
How baby-faced did they look?
I know, right?
Yes.
Speaking of the history being written all over their faces, Mike.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, but also, I mean, I did particularly like, I mean, this whole thing of introducing this whole new element and, you know, but having it be, you know, I mean, my impression of the Men of Letters was, I mean, you know, almost like, you know, it's, there's a sort of Masonic feel to them, you know, especially this whole thing, you know, is my initiation. I don't, you know, I was about to be given all the secrets and, you know, and so, yeah, basically, you know, so yeah, this is all being predicated on him, you know, not being privy to it yet, just, you know, sort of operating on the little knowledge he had. And we all know a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And sure enough, it's, you know, turns out being, you know, to be the jump forward that causes his son to think he's abandoned and not follow the path and, you know, and yeah, and become a hunter instead. And so I like the idea of it setting up this, you know, whole sort of, you know, how that created this whole generational shift that, you know, they can now go back and try and correct, you know, that, you know, while it seems that, you know, staying within the continuity of the show from the earlier seasons. And of course, it's given me even more incentive to go back and watch that.
I'll definitely say that the Masonic thing does work for me as well, because it does have that exclusivity to it. You know, I joked that Wesley Wyndham Price in his early years on Buffy, this would have been his wet dream of an organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, this...
They're the Watchers' Council.
Yeah, there you go. They're the Watchers' Council without any, like... without any
with
chance
the, of those being... Slayers.
Yeah, exactly. If you split the Watchers and the Slayers up completely, that's what it would be. But at any rate, yeah, this is definitely a good direction for them to take, and I'm really looking forward to it. So I gave this one an 8. I know it's not probably as high as might be indicated by some of the things that we've said, but again, I'm just going to say that I felt it was a little clunky because of the info dump and how they did the retconning. How about you, Brunstone?
I'd also give it an 8. I think that it's very telling. We've talked and talked and talked and talked about the mythology and the info dump and all that sort of stuff, and very little about the quote-unquote episode itself, which I thought was a little... The actual plot line was a little pedestrian. There were very few surprises in kind of sense. Like, as soon as you saw the guy and he jumped forward in time, you know, okay, this is going to be Granddad. And just the way that the conflict unfolded, I didn't think it was one of the better, you know, Winchester brothers do their research, they've got the help of an ally, they fight and stuff, blah, blah, blah. That kind of thing I thought was okay, but not the best. It was kind of I kind of had the observation, it was all of this new mythology, invasion, blah, 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 that saved the episode not saved the episode, but really elevated it above that average rating. So yeah, I give it an 8.
Mm-hmm. And Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, I'll go along with the 8 as well, but it is more for the setup than for the actual, you know, plot. And you know, as much as she was a super demon and easy on the eyes, it was like, yeah, you know, actually taking her out seemed, you know, kind of run of the mill and just sort of standard Winchester brother stuff in the end.
I don't know. I did love the demon trap on a bullet idea.
Yeah,
like, I have no idea how practical that was, but I was just, you know what, that's cool.
You know, and that actually was one of the things that harkened back to the earlier seasons, because, you know, back then it was really important to get something like the cult. And that was it. Just having the magic bullets and the gun was the, you know, that was going to be the thing that was going to help them out, not any of this other bigger stuff that we've seen since then. So this felt like a nice kind of retro thing for them to do.
Yeah, I think that was one of the, when I finally saw the previously odd, I mean, that was the biggest shot that jumped out at me of, you know, no, if I'd seen that bullet with the, you know, with the rune on the front of it, it's like, you know, yeah, I might have figured out what was going on at the end there a little quicker.
Mm. But as you say, I think they did a nice job of making it easy for people to kind of jump up on it.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so let's see then. That being done, we can move on to Arrow. And here is the promo.
The only thing more dangerous than the world's most addictive drug is the dealer.
One bullet left. Take your revenge.
Or you could shoot yourself. It's your choice.
All right, and let's see. That would be Arrow, Season 1, Episode 12, Vertigo. Oliver hunts down a drug dealer known as the Count to prevent the distribution of a new drug known as Vertigo after Thea has been arrested for using it. While Oliver turns to a former girlfriend and current vice cop for help, Moira defends Thea and Felicity learns more about Moira. That's an interesting way to put it. I like how in the description here they get very... very technical about Felicity, you know, this very minor character, yet Oliver turns to a former girlfriend and current vice cop. Okay. It's kind of vague, but at any rate, when I was watching this episode, a couple things came to my mind, and the first was that maybe the writers had been watching reruns of The Cape when they thought up the Count, because he felt a little out of place with what we've seen so far in Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Gable, he did his best to make it still fun to watch, but it just felt a little broad for me, a little over the top. Not too far, thankfully, but it was a little hard for me to take seriously. And maybe that's because it took so long for Oliver to actually encounter him and deal with him that it felt like there was no real development for the Count to give us a reason why he was the way that he was. So it wasn't as grounded as we are used to. And also, like I said, the fact that the first half of the episode was really just set up. It took a long time to get to something that was going to be wrapped up by the end of the episode. So structurally, I think it threw me off a little bit too. So there's really two sides of this episode for me. And the first side is, again, Oliver as the hooded man. They really need to give him the name Green Arrow already, so that, because it's getting a little awkward, almost like the blur on Smallville was. But I feel like his confrontation with the Count and finally starting to do something about the situation in the Glades was a nice way to get things kicked off in that respect, because we know that sooner or later Oliver and Merlin are going to be battling in the Glades, because that's where Merlin has all of his little plans. But then you've got that going on, and that was kind of superhero-y, comic book-y type stuff. And then contrast that with what was going on at the beginning, which was a somewhat interesting commentary on the Queens themselves. Because as much as Oliver is doing an ostensibly good thing by taking down this drug lord, his reason for doing it is because he feels like his sister is entitled to get away with what she did. And yes, while I don't particularly enjoy this idea of a judge just taking it in his own hands to say, hey, you know what, a lot of people get away for doing this, and I'm going to make an example out of you because you are going to be in the public eye because you are rich and this is something that usually doesn't happen to you. Okay, that's a little unnecessary to decide to legislate from the bench in that way. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but if she does have a past history and they've managed to quiet it up before, and Oliver is kind of learning a little bit about how to widen his point of view, I really think it's interesting that his basis for doing all of this is flawed, that he's doing it for reasons that aren't that noble. He's basically trying to get his sister out of the consequences of her actions. And that, to me, is interesting. They didn't really go as far with that as I thought they could have. But at the same time, now that they've introduced it, it's another stone in the foundation for Oliver moving on and evolving as an individual and as a hero. So to me, yeah, this was a little bit of an odd, kind of sloppy episode. But Edmund, how about you? What did you think?
I mean, I definitely agree in terms of the characterization of the Count. I mean, it was, you know, yeah, I mean, it wasn't quite, Adam West Batman broad, but it was sort of verging on that territory. The thing with Thea, I mean, that in terms of what the judge did, that didn't bother me so much because that does happen. Judges do reject plea deals, and I thought the reasoning they gave was actually was plausible. You can have your disagreements in terms of whether he should or should not be doing it, but it did make sense. And certainly, as you say, I mean, the direction that we expect the character to take, it's not quite the comic book, but you would expect Oliver to be, getting to a more socially conscious position. But to do that, you may have to make some missteps and have something to reform from along the way. So I definitely agree with that take on it. This is something he's going to have to learn from. What you were saying about the structure, one of the issues that I think they do need to work on some is that, there's sort of so many threads and so many balls they're trying to keep in the air each week. And, I don't know if it's a case of, where they need to, try and separate them out between episodes more rather than trying to hit, have something about the family and Laurel and Tommy and the villain of the week and, all these different elements, don't necessarily have to be in each episode. And that's something that, perhaps, in the course of this first season, they can, work on balancing out better. Overall, there was some good stuff going on. In terms of that lead up to finally meeting the Count and bringing back the Russian mobsters again, but having them, go through that whole test and initiation to continue giving them some help, and also the fact they had figured out who he was, which made them a little more believable as well. That was one element where, I thought they actually were playing well on what they'd set up earlier in the season and all this stuff, but, now that he's going around actually, killing the henchmen, but bringing the top guys to justice, it was kind of almost leading to that moment of, where you could kind of believe that maybe he was choking that guy out, until, of course, then it turns out it's just pressure points. And lo and behold, after the big treachery of the previous week on the island, that is in fact where he learned to do that. Things remain a little more complicated than they might have appeared last week as far as his little 5-year sojourn. So, I mean, that, you know, and again, actually, I mean, that, you know, that that's yet another thread which they keep incorporating into every episode. And, you know, it's, you know, they do only have the 42 network minutes to do everything. So I think that might be part of the issue. Still, overall, I mean, it's, you know, what's remarkable is that, you know, some shows faced with trying to juggle all that, it would just be this ungodly mess that, you know, we'd be complaining about things being dropped. And, you know, they're still doing a good job of keeping everything going, even if it does feel a little messy at times, but it's still overall, you know, enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, Bronstam, how about you? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna have to say that the flashbacks to the island were my favorite part of the episode for reasons that were much more that were defined much better in the past few minutes. I mean, it's just the double standard of what Oliver was trying to do, just going completely unremarked on. The way that they characterize the main bad guy, the fact that they just tried to bring in a new character is just like, oh, hey, remember this person that we're clearly supposed to have known about for ages and ages, just which felt really, really awkward. There were just so many bits in the present-day Starling City story that dragged the whole thing down. I think the most positive thing that happened was that, well, apparently, totally blanking on the name, no, Felicity, yeah. Apparently Felicity is going to be a slightly more important character going forward, which, personally, I'm all for.
Yeah, I can't exactly argue with that myself, but go ahead.
That's like, that was, honestly, yeah, I found that was the best thing about the whole present-day storyline. I found the stuff on the island much, much more interesting. I'm genuinely interested in how this whole thing's going to, in just what the hell kind of place Oliver's in beyond the simple thing of, oh, this is a prison camp, except that's probably not right. There's all kinds of funky things going on. Just whose side is his island savior mentor really on? That was the far, far, far more engaging part of the episode. I'm really keen to see what happens next in the flashbacks. They're doing a really, really good job of telling in the show as a whole, not specifically this episode, they're doing a really, really good job of telling two complete stories at once and showing us how they intersect and how one leads into the other. And I normally find both of them really, really engaging. This week, the present day stuff, not so much.
Right, and I think that's the difference. I mean, they've always been doing this thing of covering a lot of different plot threads, but I think it was more obvious here just how much they try to cram in, because one of the biggest elements of the episode, which was the whole thing against the Count and this fight against the Vertigo dealing, was just sloppy. It just didn't work. And because of that, it made a lot of the other things that normally would be easy to overlook a lot harder to overlook. But at any rate, I gave this one, as I recall, a 7, because of just the fact that it was a little bit off in terms of the cohesiveness of it. How about you, Edmund? What would you give it?
I think I'm good with the 7 as well, although what Bronstam just said, you know, kind of got me realizing, you know, I mean, it's because, you know, no, I mean, there were the strong elements on the island, and then it was brought down a bit by some of the incoherence in the present day.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Bronstam? What would you give it?
I almost want to go down to a 6, but I'll keep it at 7 because, you know, I don't know, I guess I still have a lot of goodwill towards this show. I mean, this is the first episode that I found really, really clunky, and the stuff on the island was pretty darn awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we gave Vendetta a trio of 7s in the past, and that was the one where we felt like they really rushed things with Huntress, and that was a little bit off kilter as well. So it seems like when their formula works, it's above average, but when it starts to break down is when it falls to average and maybe even below that. But it's that momentum thing that we've talked about in the past, where it takes a couple episodes of messing up like that before the goodwill gets taken out of the equation. You know, you want to give them the benefit of the doubt and let them kind of have their moments of weakness before you start to really dock them for it, unless it's something blatant. And that's usually the way that it goes. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter @Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...
Please, time is of the essence. Which of you is John Winchester?
Neither.
It's impossible. That's absolutely... What did I do wrong?
Who the hell are you, mister?
Not now. I'm thinking. Please. I can assure you there's no need for violence. One of you must know John Winchester.
I'll tell you what. When one of us falls out of your closet, then you can ask the questions.
Yes, my apologies. Is it absolutely essential, sir, that you keep your hands on me? Thank you. Gentlemen, in the absence of any and all other explanations, I'm afraid this has been a marvelous, tragic misunderstanding. I'll be on my way.
Well, that's not happening.
There are things of grave importance. I do not have time to deal with the likes of you.
You're not going anywhere, 007. Till we get some answers.
How did he do that? Oh, you gotta be kidding me!